Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Hella scary, dude. I'm not even kidding.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This week, we talk to Darlene Ortiz. Darlene is best known for her iconic pose on the cover of Ice-T's 1988 album Power, a shot that no one who has seen it has ever forgotten. But there's far more to her than bathing suits and guns. Darlene was right by Ice-T's side during his rise to the top of the rap game. The two met when she was a 17-year-old hip-hop obsessive, and they quickly became rap's first power couple. Darlene appeared on Ice-T's album covers and in his videos, and was right by his side for tours, TV appearances, movie roles, and the infamous Cop Killer controversy. Darlene has a brand new memoir called Definition of Down, My Life with Ice-T and the Birth of Hip-Hop, published by Over the Edge Books, a company run, incidentally, by our episode 57 guest, Paul Stewart. We met up with Darlene at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you enjoy The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another iconic Los Angeles rap figure, Cypress Hill's DJ Muggs, on episode 30. You can find out more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter so you can keep up to date on everything we're doing. And now, here's the woman who redefined power, Darlene Ortiz. We were just talking about it off air for a second. I wanted to start, make sense to start with Fab Five Freddy. You tell a very funny story about him in the book about how he got you fired from your very first job.
Yes.
But you knew him already at that point. So how'd you guys meet?
Well, no, actually, we knew of him, but I hadn't physically met him until about 2 weeks prior to that.
So he barely knew you when he got you fired from your job.
Exactly. So we knew of each other. He knew who, you know, Ice was, this guy in L.A. who was, you know, trying to get a deal and yada, yada. But we became friends right then and there at this big art gallery function for graffiti artists who Fab brought about five of them down, A1, and a bunch of people. It was excellent. It was so great. And we just happened to attend. I mean, you know, we were all about everything hip-hop. So when we heard about this, graffiti showing going on, it was huge in this big factory. We showed up there, and that was my first actual physical, connection with Fab. And then I ended up, it was long story short, the owner the person who threw the function on, his wife said, or his girlfriend said, hey, I love your look. It was crazy. There's a picture in the book with me wearing like a zebra outfit and you see graffiti in the background and my hair is like in a crazy mohawk.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that's the night that I met Fred. And that woman said, your look is just incredible. I want you to come work for me. And I go, okay, I've never worked a day in my life. I'm barely 18 years old. I've never had a job before. So she said, I want you to come work for me. I said, you got it. And before I could even answer, Ice is like, yeah, she'll take the job. And her restaurant was going to open for 3 weeks. So she said, but that's okay. Here, hold on. And she called Doug Christmas over, who was this big art dealer in L.A. at the time on Melrose, at Gemini Gel or something like that. I forget the name of the art gallery. Anyway, she calls him over and says, hire her. She needs to start Monday. And so I start working at this art gallery. Well, Fred had some pieces in there.
Yeah.
So he sees me and he's like, hey, I hear you're starting to work here. I said, I know. It's my first day. For 2 weeks straight, I let him use the phone. And he ran up that bill because he kept saying, Darlene, come in. Now, mind you, can I come in and use the phone? I'm thinking, I work there, so what am I going to do, refuse some guy right. that I met that's mega, and he's got pieces in there, say, no, sorry, Fred, you can't use the phone. I was like, sure. Little did I know he was going to spend hours
right. now
every
the
day.
LA office of Fat Bud Fred.
Thank you. No, for real. He had his feet up. He was sitting and he had his feet up on the desk, on the owner's desk and everything. So I thought everything was okay.
Right.
2 weeks later, who knows to this day how much that bill added up, but that man was furious. And sure, fired me. And I thought, well, darn you, Fred. So we laugh about it to this day.
That's amazing. And, you know, obviously you said you were very into hip hop even at that point, you know, early, mid 80s. But it was really kind of the whole B-boy scene that really drew you in, the kind of dance side of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you remember about kind of the B-boy scene of kind of mid-80s L.A.?
Well, for me, I wasn't in L.A., so I was in a, like, I guess, outskirts of L.A., a place called Corona, California. What's up? It's in Riverside, California.
Yeah.
I ride motorcycles, shoot guns. You know, I was a tomboy. And so we were just grabbing anything that was hip-hop, because I was like, it's this new thing, it's me, it's got my name all over it. And so, of course, it was just very commercial. So at that point, I reached for the commercial part, which was Breaking. The first right. Breaking movie had come out, and, you know, we're like, oh, you know, and the vivid color, the colors and everything, and then, so we had a dance crew, who, by the way, they all live in here in Brooklyn. They had moved out there for a little while. It's all in the book, and they came last night to support, because we've stayed friends all these years.
Oh, that's great.
So, anyway, I created this dance group, and we would do these competitions. And in the book, as you probably read,
yeah.
I entered this competition, and I met one of the judges, and he was this mega superstar in our minds, Ozrock.
Adolf Ozrock Alvarez was a b-boy and actor who appeared in such mid-80s films as Body Rock and Making the Grade. He was one of the first b-boys on the West Coast to break into the mainstream. He was famous for spilling water onto the linoleum right before he danced in order to spin faster. He passed away in 2010.
Yes, and he was from New York, Cuban descent, and he asked me for my number. So I was like, oh my God, that was like, you know, like groupie status. My first thing, like, yes, of course, here you go. And that's it. And he said, hey, have you ever been a Radiotron? And I was like, oh, the Mecca.
Right, because they had filmed the movie.
That's
the
right.
Breaking movie.
Yeah. So I said, no, not yet. And he goes, you got to come. And I said, I'd love to. And that was it. Once I went there, it was...
Specifically with the dances, who would you learn... What are some of the dances you would learn? Like, who would you learn
Uprocking.
Uprocking, or rocking, originated as a battle dance style amongst Latinos in Brooklyn in the 1960s. It spread quickly and, by the 1980s, was part of the larger hip-hop dance scene.
I would just look at it and just mimic it. I was already a dancer, you know, with my family. We play music at every single, it doesn't have to even be a party. We would just turn it on the evening and just dance and go crazy. So I would see like Rocksteady Crew, you know, doing all these dance shows, in which, by the way, I just saw Crazy Legs out in L.A. and took a picture, actually, and posted, because I gave him a book. He's in there, a great picture of him when he was a teenager. But anyway, I would just catch whatever I could. You know, even though we didn't have, of course, DVRs and things like that. But
right.
If anybody were to say, hey, so-and-so is going to be on, like, American Bandstand or Soul Train, I was all over it.
Now, it may be difficult for many of us to understand the sense of hope, accomplishment, and identity that so many young people have gotten out of breaking. But then again, it would be far more difficult for most of us to even try breaking. And that is the key.
So I just, like, ate up anything dance. You know, I would just see it and just practice it and mimic it. So
how would you describe some of the Heartbreakers routines?
Oh, wow. Well, I have an uncle who's like 2 years younger than me, and everybody thought it was my brother. And they did the like pop locking and like rougher stuff, version stuff of everything. And the girls did like the lighter side of the stuff, you know. But it was a very, very choreographed. And it was then at some point the girls all left and said, okay, yeah, this was fun for a while, but we're gone. And I stayed the only girl. So it would be a whole crew of guys called the Royal Knights. And so then they let me join because I was like the so-called leader of the Heartbreakers. So it was like, oh, we got the main one. So it was awesome. I mean, for about 2 years, we went around and we did contests and we'd win little prizes and you know, trophies.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But no, not a lot of people know about that, because when I met my ex, everybody just assumes, oh, he just met this girl. No, I was already in the, you know,
right.
In that world.
There is footage of you at Radiotron mm-hmm. on the mic also.
Oh, don't, yeah, don't sleep.
Yeah.
No, that wasn't like my call, but what would happen was it was a youth center. So we were trying to do it all. You know, we didn't know. We're just like, what? Oh, that rapping thing, I could do that. Hey, Wes, he's going to do that. You know, we didn't know what we were doing or saying, but I was more on the dance side.
Right.
But every now and then they'd go, hey, let's just have fun, and here you go. You know what I'm saying? And everybody just ramble on and just do their own little freestyle. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
What would a typical night during that, you started going to Radiotron like 84?
84, 85, and I met Ice at 85. So about a year and few months is
right.
Yeah.
What would a typical night at that club be like?
Wow. Well, it was in MacArthur Park. So if you haven't been to LA and have been to MacArthur Park, even today, it's a little on the seedy side, you know, and I still can't believe it. Yeah, I go there now and I can't believe that I have to tell my nieces. They're like, you slept in cars on this street, you know? And I go, well, I wanted to get up and dance the next day. I was so desperate. But it was awesome. It was, you know what it was? It gave me that feel of like here. Like being in New York, because I would just see, I hadn't been in New York yet, of course, but I would see these visuals of New York and I said, God, this is as close as it gets. You know, I feel like I'm in that city.
Amazing. Yeah. So one of the things about LA, and this was true also in New York and Philly in the 80s and hip hop, and it's kind of a thing people forget about, is the importance of skating rinks.
Oh,
right.
Wow.
How crucial skating rinks were. And it's kind of almost unthinkable these days because skating rinks are like a different
entity.
That's it. Entity.
With drive-ins, they're gone. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were skate clubs like in sort of 80s Southern California? Like, what was their role?
Well, first of all, I mean, you can attend a skating rink underage. You know what I'm saying? So we would hear about these major clubs and events and things, but you couldn't go because you weren't 21 or 18. So most of the functions we attended were at skating rinks. Matter of fact, the very first time I so-called laid eyes on Ice-T was at a skating rink there in Riverside. They had the crew from the movie Breakin' come and do like a guest spot. Matter of fact, the girl who showed up last night, my friend of over 30 years in my dance crew, has a picture of him turning around and he's rapping a song from the movie Breakin'. And we're there as fans. This is literally 2 years before I met him.
Wow.
And
so you were in the same room together and didn't know.
And with a whole crowd. And he turns around and he points right at me. And my friend, 2 years before I met him.
Wow.
That's what I'm saying. It was some amazing things that have happened and, you know, that have to do with that whole relationship. So it's pretty incredible.
So when you first meet Ice-T, you're 17 years old.
Almost 18.
Almost 18.
Really close.
A few months away from being 18.
Stone's throw.
Yeah. He's, you know, 9 years older, has a girlfriend already who I think he was living with.
Well, yeah, but they were broken up.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And no... no car, no phone.
Nope.
Those are some pretty big negatives. To start right off the bat.
Yeah, but you're speaking a girl that's not even 18 yet. So I'm just thinking like, I don't care. This guy is fly. You know, at the time I was like, whoa, I was just so turned on by him that I was like, I didn't care. You know, and he was so upfront. And that turned me on even more. It didn't seem like he was playing or, you know, lying or whatever. So he was upfront about everything and literally told me that. Look, I live with this girl. We're done with, but I don't want to throw her out. I've got her in school right now. But look, I'm feeling you. Can I get your number? Let's communicate. Not a problem. And he gave me so many compliments as, to me, a grown man's version compared to anybody before that.
Right.
And I was done. I was done. I was just like, oh, you know.
Yeah. And to move backwards a little bit, the book kind of starts with your family life.
Mm.
And your parents, you paint them as really vivid characters, you know. So what can you tell us a little bit about Pete and Rose?
Wow. Wasn't ever supposed to happen, but it did somehow. But that just tells you how awesome dumb my dad was to think that he could actually come in and, how they say, Superman and change this woman. So didn't happen, but he tried. Rose had at that point had four girls by different men and was a mess. You know, she was just a mess. And my dad thought that he could change her. They had me. She bounced. By the time she was getting ready to have me, they weren't together anymore. So she gave me it for adoption. But my dad was awesome. Came, rescued me, $80, you know, his military ID, and she's yours. Here you go. From the hospital, right from the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but my dad and his family made up for, I didn't miss anything. I mean, you know, so rest Rosie's heart in peace, but her and her family are still a mess. She's now gone, as you probably read.
Right.
But her entire family is like that. They're a wreck.
And, you know, you make it sound in the book like your father, who you lived with for the first 3 years of your life and would spend a lot of time with, that his house was like much more stable and loving than your mother's house. But it was a time when, you know, fathers didn't get custody.
And honestly, they still don't.
Yeah. I guess, you know, can you talk about, as a kid, dealing with that, like, institutional bias that, like, no matter how bad things got, even when in some cases you were literally bleeding,
yeah,
they wouldn't place you with your dad.
I didn't realize then, of course. I just thought, hey, this is just so messed up because this is just the way it is. And of course, now I would love to do more research and be an advocate for single fathers that are just being overlooked. And, you know, the mother just automatically gets mad love, like, oh, you're the mom, here, take her. That's how it was then. It wasn't really my dad that was, like, raising me. I was in my grandmother's home. So it was my grandmother, my grandfather. My dad was still in the service. He wasn't out yet. They let him go, I think, earlier because he got, at the time, temporary, or my grandmother had custody of me. So, but it was a whole family. So it wasn't just my father at that point. But later on, when he did get his own place, and I would have to come and visit him. But other than that, it was my grandparents and my aunts and uncles. And, I mean, it was just lovely. Made up for everything that was happening on the other side.
Right. Which is why you ran away over there
all the
so
time,
much.
Every yeah. day. Yeah, because they were literally like a mile and a half away, and I would literally leave earlier for anything just to go and hang out with them before I ever, you know, went to anything, school, a function, sporting events. I would literally leave Rose because there was nothing. I mean, literally, it's like, okay, yeah, you just have to live here because you're this kid, and legally, I have to just have you living here.
Right.
That's how bad it was. But, you know,
yeah.
It was what it was. I survived.
Yeah. And music-wise, as a kid, what kind of music were you into? And I ask because, like, you have this, you know, moment where you go to a skating rink and you kind of find, mm-hmm. like, oh, these are, you know, people of a different race than me, but they like the same music I like, and they react to me, and I feel like I fit in. But that by that point, you already knew a lot about Black music.
Oh, yeah, because my father was very open like that, and he loved it. It's interesting because there's such a mix in my family. So I got to know, it's funny because my friends teased me. They said, don't play anything. Watch, Darlene will know every song that comes on the radio. I might not know, what group was that? Oh, I don't know, but I know every single lyric. It was very therapeutic to me. So I would listen to, I'd put on any kind of album. But everybody was into something different. My sister, who was closest to me, was into like Peter Frampton and yeah, groups like that. And then my dad was into total strong R&B. So we're Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder. And then my other older sister was into Elton John. And he goes, so I had it cover the whole gamut. With my mom was into country here and there, but I just love every single type of genre of music.
So you meet Ice, you know, you guys struggle for a couple of years. He's doing, you know, some singles. When he first does the record, I even forget what the A side is because the B side kind of took over.
Cold Wind Madness was Ice-T's very first single from 1983. The song was recorded in Minneapolis and featured Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, then of the time, and later to write and produce hits for Janet Jackson, George Michael, Mariah Carey, and countless others. When I was brought into this world, my mama never asked, I was a poor girl, plus I rolled over to her and gave her a kiss. She said, yo, daddy, don't rock me like this. When the doctor hit me on the behind, I broke on down with a funky rhyme. The nurses said I was awfully cute when I played at the joint in a
I was when six in the one where six in the morning was the B-side.
Six in the morning, police at my door, fresh Adidas squeak across the bathroom floor.
Ice-T's 1986 single on Techno Hop Records had Dog in the Wax, You Don't Quit Part 2 on the A-side, with his early classic Six in the Morning relegated to the B-side. Got a knot in my pocket when least
the grand, gold on my neck, my pistol's close at hand. I'm a self-made. Did you know that when you heard that was going to be the early song of his that people remembered?
Absolutely not. I mean, I didn't. I mean, here's this guy telling me that this is what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
Whatever. Just knock your socks off, honey. I'm going to keep going to work. Keep trying to support us while you do that. I didn't care. I honestly put that. I didn't care if anything unfolded from any of that stuff. I just was excited to be in this relationship with this man that he could have just said, okay, I changed my mind. I want to be a, you know, street. You know, pavement layer. Wonderful. I mean, that's how deep I was into this guy. So
it didn't
matter if he was going to be success at it or not.
Wow. And so he realizes, I think in 86, mm-hmm. that no record deal is happening in LA. At that time, there wasn't sort of the infrastructure there.
Yeah.
And he comes here. He comes to New York.
Sure does.
So you have your boyfriend saying, hey, I'm going to New York. I don't know for how long, just as long as it takes me to get a record deal.
Mm-hmm.
Was that scary for you?
Oh, hell yeah. Because I was like, now I'm going to be by myself. We were so strapped on money. We had a pit bull felony. And we had no money. And she ends up busting the bed. So I'm at work. And we had a water bed. That's the 80s. And so she busted. So we were so in debt. But it was like all these things happening. But He came and he did what he said he was going to do, conquered it. I couldn't believe it. He called me like, what was it, a month later, almost 2 months later, and said, I got a deal. I was like, what? It was, oh, That was an amazing film. But I was scared out of my wits because we were literally scrounging around. We were calling people like, look, almost, I wish crowdfunding was what existed then, because I literally was scraping everything together, and we would literally Western Union him everything. And because I believed in him, whether it was going to happen or not. But yeah, he did it. It's remarkable.
Yeah. And that trip was really important in a lot of ways in terms of like setting him up with, you know, OGs in New York, obviously, like, you know, Africa Islam and Bentley Mel and all of these, you know, sort of, even at that point, old school New York rappers. Can you talk a little bit about that trip and what it did for him in terms of setting him up in terms of people he knew?
It set almost the entire West Coast up, really, if you think about it, because at the time, they didn't know anything West Coast. I mean, he came here and he literally broke down those doors. I mean, he said, look, honey, get ready. We're coming back to New York. We still hadn't had any money yet, so we scrounged that together, and he came back. I quit my job. We said, you're never going to have to work for anybody else again. Let's go. It's all on from now. Yeah. And we literally flew to New York, stayed in Islam's place in the Bronx for like a week, and before we got a check from Warner Brothers, and then after that, it was entirely different lifestyle for rest of the time, pretty much. But the trip was so interesting, because here I am, fans of these people that, what? Now they're in my presence. I'm like, who, what? I'm kicking it in this place in the Bronx. And here comes, you know, doorbells are ringing, and in are walking these people that I'm like, oh my God, the message? That's the message? And it goes Melly Mel, and it's like, and Mike Tyson, a carpa. I mean, it literally in one night, almost one of the first evenings here in New York. I mean, like I said, I always wanted to write a story because it was just incredible how things happened and were unfolding for me.
Yeah. You know, so he does his debut album, and you're on the cover of Rhyme Pays.
Rhyme Pays.
Was that the first time you'd modeled, even? Or?
For public. Not really. Yeah, it was. It was, yeah. But like I said, anything for that dude. Seriously, honestly, it could have went so wrong. Because that's how he's so manipulative, but in a good way, and at that time with me. Mm-hmm. Like, in other words, but it teaching me a lot of stuff. Like you said, he's darn near 10 years older than me.
Right.
So, yeah, it could have went very wrong if you think about it. Because prior to that, he did have some pimping game when he was in the Army and all that. But he just said, like, no, you're the one. You know, he even says years later when we were together, like, wow, you know what I could have done? I know, because I was like this, you know. So thank God that he did, as we called it back in the day, he didn't have any larceny in his heart for me.
Right. What was it like for you to be on an album cover at that point?
Mega. Yeah. I mean, to me, I was just like, but at the same time, that one like totally was under the radar. Mm-hmm. Like I would go home and people would go, you did an album cover. Oh, okay. That's interesting. It wasn't a huge thing. Nobody was into it. Nobody was getting it. Not in my hometown. Right. But when Power hit, it was entirely different. It was almost like Rhyme Pays didn't even exist.
That cover, obviously, which, you know, an image, a part of that serves as the cover of your book, mm-hmm. Definition of Down. That cover, it's, you know, perhaps the best known image of you. So when you finally saw it, do you have any idea, like, oh, 25 years later, people are still going to be talking about this?
Heck no. No way. I actually thought it was kind of comical when we were doing it. We knew it was a deep, you know, cover that we were shooting, you know, with the guns and the sex and, you know, showing all that and the deepness of it all. But it was funny to us because, you know, of course, Glenn was so shy and it was like, oh, God, I've never shot a woman. This is ridiculous. You know, but Tracy was like, Ice. I hate calling him Ice T. I'm not used to that yet, even to today. But he was like, no, don't worry. This is what I have a plan. Because even at the time that Glenn was shooting it, which, by the way.
Sorry, this is Glenn Friedman,
by the way. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Glenn E. Friedman is a photographer and artist who is known for his iconic images of both hip-hoppers and punk and hardcore musicians. In addition to the covers of Ice-T's first two albums, Rhyme Pays and Power, Glenn shot Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, the Beastie Boys' Check Your Head, LL Cool J's Bigger and Deafer, and Suicidal Tendency's self-titled debut album, which he also produced.
Legend. Yeah. So he didn't know how it was all going to unfold. Tracy's just like guiding him, da-da-da-da-da, and he's like that with everything. He's like, so this is what's going to happen, and then eventually we're going to have three of us, and it's going to look like we're next to each other, da-da-da-da. So, but he totally was in control of that whole thing. There's a video out there. What is it called? Ice sold it. Like he would sell it in record stores. And he's got the live of the video, the photo shoot of Power.
Here we are on the set of the new 12-inch and album cover power, as you see. Fly shit all over the place. What do you got there? Okay.
So, and then Glenn's like embarrassed and he's trying to shoot the photo and his face is all red and they're making fun of him.
One of the things you sort of reveal in the book is that, you know, your standing up straight wasn't as easy as it might have seemed.
Not with that gun,
yeah,
not holding
the gun
that.
Was so
it was real. It wasn't plastic. People think it was real. I said it was real. And it was like, and you could see in the video where I'm like, okay, whew, let's take a break.
Real good. Stay still. Perfect.
Start to shake.
Okay. That's good enough.
Is it a wrap?
It's a wrap.
And then we'd set back up again. It was, yeah, it was interesting. We just recreated that, by the way. Well, not recently. About 4 years ago through Vibe magazine.
Right, I saw that for I think the 20th anniversary.
Uh-huh.
Of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that was, wow, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
My bad.
It flew by. So the Power cover, it didn't happen without some backlash, right?
Big time.
Yeah, there were critiques of you and critiques of, you know, the cover saying like the pictures were degrading to women and
right.
stuff. At the time, what did you think about those?
Well, because, see, those people are on a totally different level. I mean, I'm thinking, well, what? I walk around like that. I might have, like, a little sarong on, but we're at Venice Beach. We're rolling like that. So it didn't even faze me.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what is the big hoopla? You know what I'm saying? And then when I got to certain places and I saw the people that were actually giving a stink or a complaint about it, and I go, oh, well, oh, poor things. You know what I'm saying? Like, I said, oh, no wonder. They're just totally not, they're not going to get it. So it's not for any, everybody doesn't get, you know, everybody's get down, and that's okay. And it just didn't faze me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not really one to care too much about.
Sure.
That, so.
And that was one of the earliest run-ins you would have with sort of censorship.
Oh, yeah. Tipper
Gore
and her crew.
Something that would come to a head in the
yeah.
early 90s, obviously. So I saw footage of some of the Oprah appearance in 1990.
Yes.
You and Ice were on Oprah with Tipper Gore.
Yeah.
Well, one of my guests today is the popular rap star Ice-T, who titles his latest album Freedom of Speech, Watch What You Say, in response to all of the criticism that he and other musicians get about their lyrics.
Now, what do you remember about that, about that day?
I remember that I didn't know about stacking of an audience. I didn't know until afterwards. So we're sitting in there, and I'm thinking, oh, look at all these nice women. Oh, this is sweet. And it's like, ah.
That's a cop-out.
No, that's my wife.
Yeah.
How many women see humor in it? The girls out here.
I don't. We're telling kids. You're sending the message to kids that brutality is fine. It's entertaining. We should laugh at it.
And, yeah, then they told me, oh, honey, it was stacked. You know, and I was like, oh, what is that? I was like, they were horrible. They all came out of nowhere. To me, it was like, again, just kind of fun. You know, it was like an interesting experience. And of course, it was funny because, like, again, I kind of just, that didn't even faze me. None of that stuff that those people were saying to me, because it wasn't a big issue in my world.
Yeah.
I was so in awe that Nelson George was on the stage and Jello Biafra. And I'm just like, oh, this is great. and plus, I always trusted Tracy, like I said, my man's handling it. But when he was like, yeah, ask my girl, I'm like, oh, my God, that's me.
Right. So, and so that footage exists of you talking during the show.
When he calls a bitch, then that means, wait, she's a bitch. When he says a bitch, I don't turn around, okay? Alexis, now there are bitches, and you must admit it. If you get up cranky or something your husband don't like and he calls you a bitch, then you were a bitch at that point. He's not saying all women. He never makes all statements.
Were you nervous about
Heck
that?
Yeah, because I was only 19 and I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm on the spot. And then Oprah was still at that time, huge in my eyes, you know?
One of the things that's funny watching it now is the styles.
Oh my God. The 80s. Come on now.
Yeah.
That's Janet Jackson's Control. I mimicked her exact same jacket. I was in love with those high shoulders. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You're in the times.
Right.
So.
Absolutely. And
yeah.
Ice as well.
Of course.
You know.
That's why I always say when people make fun of like, look what you had on. Really, I would like to see how you looked in that era. So go somewhere with that.
Definitely. Definitely. You say in the book, you know, you talk about the PMRC and kind of the fight against it and ICE's role in it. And you mentioned that someone else who had a big role in that was Frank Zappa.
Yeah.
Frank Zappa was instrumental in the fight against Tipper Gore's Parents Music Resource Center organization and their drive to censor explicit lyrics. He made countless media appearances speaking out against the group on shows like Larry King Live and Nightline, and even testified before a Senate committee in 1985.
Golden shower, oh God, I am the American dream. With a spindle up my butt till it makes me scream. And I'll do it.
Did you meet him at all during that period?
No. I mean, we had seen him. Like, I'd be at places. Tracy would do all the talking and stuff to people, but not necessarily met and like, hey, oh, nice to meet you. So, no, from afar, but mm-hmm. in the same room, sure. Jello Biafra had a huge part in that, too. Yeah, he was down big time with that.
And so another thing that happened involving you guys in censorship that was even more serious was, of course, the whole cop killer situation.
Wow. Yes. Oof.
For every cop that has ever taken advantage of somebody, beat them down or hurt them because they got long hair, listen to the wrong kind of music, wrong color, whatever they thought was the reason to do it. For every one of those fucking police, I'd like to take a pig out here in this parking lot and shoot him in their motherfucking face.
Cop Killer is a 1992 protest song by Ice-T's metal band Body Count. It is sung by a character who is fed up with police brutality and decides to take revenge. The song was met with opposition by many law enforcement agencies and politicians, up into including the then President Bush. Pressure was put on Sire Records' parent company Time Warner to pull the record, and some executives there even received death threats. In the end, Ice decided to pull the song off his album, in large part out of fear for the safety of the people who worked at his label. He left Sire Warner Brothers the following year, after further disputes over the content of his follow-up solo album, Home Invasion. Cop Killer has, to this day, never been re-released.
What was that like from your perspective, particularly because at that point you had a newborn?
Hella scary, dude. I'm not even kidding. Because at that point, we didn't have so much exposure like we do now to find out what's going on or what's unfolding. So people didn't know that government officials were going to literally where his daughter, because our kid was too young to go to school, but literally pulled Ice's daughter out of her class and literally were asking her questions about it. I mean, that's how deep it got. I mean, when you have the vice president saying, this guy here.
In June of 1992, Vice President Dan Quayle denounced Cop Killer while speaking to members of the National Sheriff's Association, quoting the song's lyrics.
Die, 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 pig, die.
He then criticized Time Warner, the parent company of Body Count's label, for, quote, supporting and making money off a record that suggests it's okay to kill cops. I find that outrageous.
You like potato, and I like potato.
We're like, whoa, they're holding up your picture. Oh, my God. And we could swear every day that our phone was tapped. You know, you could hear all these weird, all of a sudden, staticky and little click sounds on our home phones. And it was pretty serious. It was pretty deep. But once again, even though it was very scary, I totally trusted this guy, and he's not your average guy, so I felt entirely safe with him. There was not one moment where I didn't think that we were going to be, you know, that we were unsafe. I knew that he would take care of us.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the crazy things is you were out on tour with your young son.
Mm-hmm. A baby, yeah.
With Body Count while all this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every venue you're met with protesters.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And these were all police officers. But, interesting enough, we'd have just as many that were protesting were in support.
Mm.
So we did have a couple of really down police officers that were like, I get where you're coming from. I understand. Do you know what I'm saying? Those brutal cops in the wrong were not those guys. So we actually had a nice, good, even amount. And that's what kind of helped. If not, it would have really been like entirely scary. But it was scary. It was pretty scary.
I'm sure. And, you know, what sort of next big phase after that was New Jack City.
Oh, my God.
This ain't business, bitch. This is personal. I want to shoot you so bad. My dick's hard.
Coming through. Excuse me.
So you were on set the whole time for
that? The entire time. I actually, between y'all, me and you.
Yeah.
I have, it's probably about 4, maybe more than that, 6 hours of video footage that no one's ever seen. I just transferred it to DVD. I, for somehow, was allowed to shoot whatever and whenever I wanted to with my video camera on the set of New Jack City. I don't know who, but they didn't, nobody said no to him.
Right.
So he said, my girl's gonna be, by the way, walking around with video cameras. Cool? Oh, yeah, all right. And nobody ever said anything. I mean, I'm literally in that fire scene where Chris Rock gets murdered. I'm in all those scenes and in a corner like, this is okay. And they're like, yes, just stay back. And I'm literally, I have all this. I have them getting makeup put on, Wesley Snipes. I'm in that wedding shooting scene. I'm literally shooting my own, footage. So nobody's ever seen that. I just transferred it, yeah.
Wow. Any plans for it or you haven't thought
that far
ahead?
I don't know. I thought I'd reach out and say, hey, throw that out there. Like, you know what? I got that.
Yeah.
And 9/10 of the law, I own that. So.
Right. Exactly.
He left it.
Absolutely. And, you know, something else you have footage of, actually, that I was curious about, like, whatever would happen, was the Dope Jam Tour from 87.
Yeah.
The Dope Jam Tour was a 1988 60-city tour that featured Ice-T, Dougie Fresh, Boogie Down Productions, Kool Moe Dee, Biz Markie, and Eric B. and Rakim. The tour's full title was The Dope Jam Tour, Say No to Drugs. As one reviewer at the time noted, it was the first anti-drug show I've been to where you could get a contact high.
Well, a lot of that was actually transferred on that same videotapes that I'm telling you. I think Ice did two of them. Mm-hmm. If you ever can find them, there are, I've seen some on eBay, but he broke those down and put them on videotapes and would sell them at like Warehouse Records back in the day.
Oh, okay.
So there's a lot of footage of people, and that's our home footage that he transferred onto a VHS and literally would commercially sell them.
Wow.
And he did pretty well with it too. But yeah, there's a lot of footage from that tour. Biz Markie shared a bus with us. I mean, it was awesome experience.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
You mentioned once in an interview that there was briefly beef on that tour between Eric B's crew and Rhyme Syndicate. Do you at all remember what that was over?
I have no idea what actually started it or triggered it, but I still know that everybody was kind of just getting to know one another. Your West Coast, your East Coast, that's a huge difference. You know what I'm saying? Like the East Coast guys, they weren't into like big into guns. It was so, in LA, you could roll around with a gun in your car and just get a little $300 fine or a ticket. So it was totally different types of guys, but you know, they all ended so quick. I don't know what was said or done, but all it was a little day or two of something happened. Matter of fact, you know what? Maybe we should ask. I've got a couple of friends out here that were there. Hassan. What's up, Hassan? He's from here. Anyway, he was there. A lot of people that were there, I go, you know what? I never asked. So I'm glad you asked that because I would like to get to know that. But it ended quick. Like everybody became, and after that, we're so tight after that. Because you can count the rappers on two hands.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? And then West Coast, maybe on two fingers at that time. So... You know, so everybody got to know one another.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about, you know, you mentioned in the book, you kind of call that tour the beginning of the end in some ways, because it was the last time that hip hop was really a small insular community where everybody knew each other.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. And that is so true. That is so true. After that, there was so many acts coming out after that. So that just, it just spread out. It was great. It was lovely. You know what I'm saying? It gave us a lot of great people right after that. But the tours changed. Everything changed. The selling of you know, albums changed. Videos changed. So, yeah. But I'm so glad that I was able to experience that.
Yeah. And, you know, since there was some of the Rhyme Syndicate people on that tour, we had a member of them, Divine Styler, on the show a little while back.
Divine!
Yeah. What do you remember so about awesome. The Rhyme Syndicate guys?
You know what? They're not just Rhyme Syndicate, a lot of other rappers, per se, but were ahead of their time. And him, definitely.
Well, yeah, he was.
Hello, hello, hello.
Time and die. To think, to learn. What we learn to think of. Thought is revolving knowledge. Knowledge is a cycle of time. Time is everything. We think we all know and all.
Love me some Divine Styler. Yeah. So you know what? I think because my ex was ahead of his time as well. So there was a lot of people that he guided and helped put out, but just wasn't their time.
Right.
But they're mega. I mean, they're just so tight. I love them to death. I mean, look, even Everlast.
I was going
to
say,
this
guy, you know, you can see him in footage from you know, the late 80s and some of the videos and things. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, he's a giant star.
Yeah, totally different, too, doing his own type of music.
Yeah.
But, man, Tracy had an eye and an ear, but it was just a head, you know? It was people weren't getting it. At that point. So it's too bad because some of those artists are just freaking great. Lord Finesse, by the way, anyway.
Lord Finesse?
Yeah, yeah. He was down with us.
Oh, wow.
Early on, very early on. He was supposed to come. Last night I was supposed to see him, but he didn't. He was showing up for somebody's birthday, but I didn't get a chance to run into him.
Yeah.
That's our guy.
So when stuff with you and Ice ends, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's 17 years later.
Yep.
You know, literally half your life has gone by, your entire adult life.
Yeah.
You know, being in this relationship. What was it like to kind of have to restart your life at that point?
Confusing. He was still somewhat taking care of us, but not to the degree that I still to this day think we both deserved, our child and myself. But I believed him. I took his word. He said he would take care of me for the rest of my life. Of course, I said, okay, well, you know, we'll make adjustments as it goes. But that's why I never felt the need to have to go anywhere like court-wise on him. I thought, no, you know, I believe this guy. I trust him. Mm-hmm. You know, why should I not believe him now? We ended. Sure, things happened. Not the end of the world, but let's move on. And then stuff started just kind of dwindling away, and people were changing their minds, and I thought, wow. But at this point now, we had a son who was at a very critical age in his life that I thought, if I do something like that, that's going to totally crush his world. It was already broken big time when his dad left us, but I've got to take the reins now. And so I just couldn't. It wasn't in me. It's not in my nature to begin with. I was never with the man for money, that's for darn sure. But at that point, too, I said, this is very important. Like, I can't do this. I couldn't do that to him and let him see his mom being that kind of woman. So I just never did. But yeah. It was quite an adjustment. It still is.
At the time your relationship ended, you had some other, right around that time, you had some really other hard stuff happen. Both your parents mm-hmm. passed away not too yeah. long after that.
Yeah. Well, my mom more recently. That just happened to make it in the book. But my dad, yeah, he died a couple years later. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, Tracy, again, he was still with me, though. When my father was got sick with cancer. And again, just so generous. Tracy is such a giving man. I mean, I just left and flew out, you know, drove out there and stayed with my grandparents and took care of my dad for like 4 years. Which, by the way, I want to quickly announce that I am going to get my death midwife certification this coming year because I have experienced that and I do hospice volunteering. I've taken care of so many loved ones that have passed, including my father. So,
wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
Hospice work is,
that's
know
my heart.
People
that's
have
my
done
passion.
It. It's incredible, incredible stuff. You don't use her name in the book, but you mention in passing mm-hmm. Corinne Steffens.
Corinne Superhead Steffens is an author, actress, and model who became infamous for her series of relationships with well-known rappers. Her 2005 tell-all, Confessions of a Video Vixen, recounted details of many of her affairs, including with Ice-T. She claimed that Ice would give her money when she needed it and set her up in an apartment. She also mentioned that he had what she called a pimp room in his office. She wrote, quote, "The pimp room had oversized red velvet curtains and black leather sofas. There were a few accessories that stood out, a giant pimptionary, a dictionary of pimp terminology, and a video camera set up on a tripod. In this room, we watched porn and made a few flicks of our own." Got a chick named Superhead. She gives Superhead.
Just moved in the building, even gave a Superhead. So you figured that one out when I
yeah.
said the girl.
Yeah.
The girl
well, between that and other interviews that you'd given,
oh, that's,
the,
yeah.
the time mm-hmm. period kind of fit. You don't have to talk about this if you
no,
don't want
no,
to.
No, no, it's all good.
What was it like for you when her book came out?
I felt really sorry for her. Like, I thought, what kind of woman writes this kind of book and then dedicates it to her son? And I just said, I really felt bad for both her and her son. And then also, at the same time, I was a bit angry in the beginning when it came out. Not at her or him, really. I was just like, the fact that she actually mentioned there's a part in her book, which I've never read, but somebody else actually showed me or whatever. And she mentioned some incident that happened with her and Ice, but says something about our son, that he was on the phone with him and saying, "Huh, well, he was, you know, while he was telling her their son this, he's on the phone, or he's with me, I'm in his presence." That I didn't dig, because I thought at some point my kid could, you know, see this later, and I don't dig that.
Right.
So that was the only thing that really chapped my hide. But other than that, I'm like, "Go on, girl, knock your socks off with all that old talk, but that's not my get down." You'd never hear me talk about any of my, you know, sexual encounters.
Right. And so now you're a radio host, among other things. Right?
Yeah, that's been fun, yeah.
5150 show with the comedian Corey Holcomb.
Compton Oreo. I'm sorry, D. We keep interrupting
no,
your
don't
shit.
No, don't be sorry with me because, yeah.
You're blowing that fan this way. I'm hot.
I enough, see but... you're all a Dewey.
A Dewey. That's that shit to be on your car in the morning, ain't it? Or you wipe it off when you leave a nasty bitch out. Dude.
It's dewy. Dewy. It's not dripping yet.
Dewy.
But it's dewy.
Shiny faces.
Anyway, pretty unique Woo. Comic personality.
Yes, he's interesting.
To say the least. How did you come to co-host that show?
I was actually out one of my favorite nights. It was a hip-hop night in L.A. called Soul Food. And I ran into a guy named Guy Black, and he's actually a radio personality in L.A. on KGLH. And at the time, though, he was working with Jamie Foxx. And he comes up to me and he says, hey, Darlene, you know Jamie. And listen, I've always thought you've had a great radio voice. Would you be interested in doing a show? I was like, heck yeah, with who? And then he says, hey, show up on Monday, and then we'll give you a little trial run. And I thought, oh, my God, with this character? But we instantly just clicked. And we were first on Sirius XM. Jamie's Foxhole, which is still exists, but the shows, the talk shows are no longer up. But we started there, and our ratings just went through the roof. And we were on there for about a good close to 4 years. And after that, Corey felt, hey, you know what? We've got a really strong following, and we don't want to let them down. So even though they kicked all the shows off, he took it into his own hands and spent his own money and has kept it going. So now we're on Ustream, but we've had many places that we've moved around to and had it done in different ways, but now we're on Ustream, so.
Excellent.
But I hear Sirius is trying to make some deals, so we'll see. I don't know.
We'll see what happens. Maybe return to satellite radio. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And, you know, with the book, the new book, Definition of Down, what made you finally decide to write a memoir?
I've always wanted to. I knew that there was a lot of unique moments in my life that people would always say. Anytime I'd even tell them just a story, they didn't know the, you know, everything. They just knew that one particular story, and they'd say, God, you've got to write a story about this. And I said, well, there's many more than that. So, but yeah, I always wanted to write a story. I just didn't know how it was, that this was going to be the ending, how it was going to end. But made for more, you know, better content for the book, I guess. But yeah, so I didn't know. You know what I'm saying? But when I started it in my mind, I knew I was going to write a story about my life, period. And like I said, I just didn't know it was going to end like that.
What was the process actually of writing the book like?
Ugh, horrible. I mean, because horrible only because I'm broke right now. Like, I've been sleeping on people's couches for 2 years just to get this book done, honestly. Heidi Sigmund-Kuda, who co-wrote it with me, actually wrote my ex's first book, The Ice Opinion. She wrote that as well. I told her, I said, I want to write a book, but I have to have you do it with me. There's no way I'm going to work with anybody else. And so just it all unfolded. In other words, just because I wanted to write a story, sure, but it all unfolded and was meant to be. So about 2 years ago, everything just came together. She ended up stopping what she was doing at the time. I ended up, my son moved out, my dog died, people were sick. I said, you know what? Wow. So I started cutting off more work, and I said, okay, I'm just going to have to deal with the brokenness, but do this book. This is what I want to do. I was determined, and both of us did it. I don't know how. And then, of course, Paul Stewart comes into the game, but I don't know how we actually did it. Honestly, I don't.
And, you know, as we're talking, I believe it was finally either yesterday or today was the official release date, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What is it like to finally have this two year long process?
I can't even describe it. It's so exciting. I can't even describe it. I'm elated. It's amazing. It's a miracle, actually.
And what has some of the advance word been like? How have people been responding to it so far?
Oh, my God. Like, for instance, last night at the Bowery Electric, we had a great time. I mean, I've got people showing up that are fans of the 5150 show that are supporting, and just old school fans. You know, people showing up that either knew me or didn't. It is just amazing support. I can't believe it. And people also that I thought were afraid to show their support for me because thinking that maybe he would, you know, act funny or his people wouldn't. So I've got people showing up that I really didn't think I'd ever see or hear from.
That's great.
Amazing.
One of the other things you've done lately is you got into songwriting.
That's right.
You wrote song lyrics for Tina Marie.
Yeah, with Tina Marie, who was my dear friend. Rest in peace. She's passed away 2 years ago. She always said, all those years hanging out with her, she said, you know what? We need to write a song together badly. I've always been giving her ideas at that point, and she said, one day we're going to write a song. And the year that she passed away, earlier that year, she said, hey, I heard you're writing a book. Because she was just as crushed. When we broke up, she couldn't believe it. It was like, broke her heart. And she said, what's the name of your book? And I said, oh, I'll have to tell you the story on how I came up with it, but it's called Definition of Down. She goes, that's it. That's our song. All my empty pockets spin, ride with you to the That's our song. went over there, and over a period of like off and on for 3 weeks, we ended up finishing it. She called me. She said, here's how it sounds. She played it for me. I was like, whoa. And 2 weeks later, she passed away.
Wow.
So it took 2 years for her daughter to get the album out, which came out earlier this year, 2015. I got my first check from BMI.
Congratulations.
And thank you. I was like, really officials? I'm not right. But just I get signs from her. I mean, I have so many people that passed away, and she's one of them. They're like my angels. But the lyrics are in this. I'm about to cry. The lyrics are in the book. And anyway, it's just very special. And I'm glad she was a part of my life.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with her? How did you guys first meet?
I have a friend that I've been friends with for over 30 years, and she's my best friend still, my godson's mother. And she literally is the goddaughter of Rick James and Tina Marie. So can you just imagine that? So she was around Prince and Tina and Rick and that whole era. And she introduced me. And ever since then, and of course she knew who my ex was, you know, being in that city in L.A., and we just became really close, just like family. And then when she had Alia, her daughter and my son were like brother and sister. So we just instantly clicked. They were like family. I mean, she'd invite us over for dinner, you know. So she got really upset when he left us. So we were determined to write this song, and little did we know that she was going to pass. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. So the lyrics are all listed in the book, and you can actually listen to the lyrics. Her daughter put this... the album out. It took her 2 years. And I think she got ripped off.
And it's Tina singing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. She's singing. Yeah.
That's great. And you think you might write more
I
songs
hope
in the
so.
Future?
I
or
have
was that
songs.
Kind of a special
I have
thing?
Songs. Adele, I have one for you. Not really. I do. I really do. And I'm a huge fan of Adele. But Tina actually wanted to do, I have a very good idea that I'm going to help, hopefully, her daughter do this project. But Tina had said, you know, it's my dream to do these duets. And one of them was with Jamie Foxx. So I'm going to try and get this a project done where people are covering all her songs. So just like the Luther Vandross song where everybody covered a song. So I would love to have, you know, that done with Tina.
And so what's next now? You're in New York, obviously, telling people about the book, getting the word out. Mm-hmm. What's next up?
You mean project-wise?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully. I mean, we're optioning for a movie. Thank you. Success to Compton. So, So hopefully that's next. I did, Heidi and myself did a, treatment for Discovery Channel. And that was, a first show that's called Love Don't Live Here. And it all has to do with my yard sales after he left us. I'd have these yard sales of all these items, and these people would get so excited because they'd say, hey, what's the story about this? And I'd say, oh, you know, this fella named Ice-T. Ice-T? And I'd say, yeah. So they were so excited. So I wrote this treatment for this a reality show about people who they were with somebody who was famous, and now they're gone, and they sell their items. So they got it. They gave us a treatment. We shot a pilot, and so it's still in their hands. So we'll see what happens with that. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds super fun.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, Darlene Ortiz, thank you so much.
Aw, thank you for having me.
For coming by.
I really
appreciate it.
I appreciate you guys.
At this point, this is where we'd normally end the show. However, if you've ever heard our show before and listened all the way through the end, you'll know that we always keep the tape rolling afterwards. And this time, we picked up something absolutely incredible. After stepping away from the mic, Darlene told us the story about the time her son, Little Ice, met his childhood idol, Paul Simon. So we're adding that on here, the time that Ice-T's son met Paul Simon.
About 6 years old, and I have this life insurance agent coming in to interview me and get me life insurance. He was the same agent for my ex. Yeah. So we're in the house, and he comes in, older white guy, you know, he's like, sits down, he's like, can't concentrate, he keeps stopping, are you okay? I guess that's it, I gotta ask. Who in this household, because now there's Punisher pictures all over the walls, and there's a pinhead standing up tall, life-size doll, there's all these things, and he goes, who in this house likes Paul Simon and the Carpenters? And I go, oh, you heard that. And he goes, I can't help it. I said, that's my son. He goes, how old's your son? I go, hey, Papa, come on out. So he comes out, he's a little guy. And he's like, hello. Such great manners, my kid. I'm sorry. Hello, sir. Yes, hope so. Pleasure to meet you and everything. I'm like, right. You like, what do you like about the car? Oh, my God, I love it. Julio down by the schoolyard, my favorite. Yeah, da, 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 da. He's going, and he's going to be a part of this group. And he's breaking down, like, all these things about Paul Simon and the Carpenters. So anyway, he says, oh, that's great. That's it. I'm thinking, end of story.
Right.
So about 30 minutes later, I get a phone call from my ex's financial managers, and they said, what's going on here? And I go, what are you talking about? And they said, we get a call from Paul Simon's people, and they invited you, me, and your kid to see him at the Greek. He was just coming back. He was returning, like, in... And Beach Boys were opening up because they had just reunited. Wow. Paul Simon and I don't know somebody else, but we didn't. And we go and we literally have all access, like parking, everything, very front row seats. Paul Simon comes out and my kid. First of all, my kid's like, "Oh, I can't stand these guys. Who are these? The Beach Boys." He hated them. And so,
I think I may have seen them around that time. Yeah. It was my first concert.
And it was at the Greek Theater. And my son, so my son comes out and he says, "Anyway, so we're in the very front." And Paul Simon comes out and literally is like the whole show. Is the two of them. He's jamming with them. He gets down on his knees. The light is on the seat. Like, yeah, do it. And they're on the Jumbotron the entire time. So after the concert ends, we go, we're walking away, and people are like, oh, my God, you're that kid. You're that kid. Well, we go in the back in this media room, and there's hundreds of people waiting. And every time the door opens, people think, oh, they're coming in to get us. And the door opens, and they come. And they excuse me. Hey, you guys, come on with us. Well, oh, all right. We're like, yeah. We're passing by hundreds of people. Pulls us to the back, takes us in the catacombs of the Greek Theater, which I've never been through.
Right.
And it's a big, huge room, two times bigger than this, with this huge fireplace in the corner.
Yeah.
They open the door. It's all empty except for Paul. And he's standing, I have pictures of this. So he's standing in the corner, and he goes, it's okay if I talk to your son. And he's like, Mom. Like, he's like this mega, like 6 years old. Nobody in his school knew who he was. They didn't care, but his teachers were all over him.
Right.
And so he's like, why are you going to see Paul then? So Paul calls him over. My son walks over. They're so hesitant. Like, I'm scared. I love him.
Yeah.
And so then he goes and they chop it up for like 20 minutes. Laughing. And he's talking to him. Nice. I've got pictures. You should see. It's
That's
great.
Hilarious.
And they both walk over. And he walks over and he goes, man, I love your kid. I said, thank you. And he goes, he tells me that all he has is my greatest collections. Is it okay to send him some things? And he sent him like all these great collections of Paul Simon stuff. Wow. And he was like, Mom, this is so awesome. And then he leaned into me and Paul Simon says, he goes, my own children don't like my music.
But Ice-T son is your biggest fan.
Thank
like,
you.
I'm trying to wrap my head around
that. Thank you. Yeah.
Talking to Darlene, I felt like I really got to experience what the 1980s LA hip-hop scene was like. The clubs, the dances, the key players. And seeing Ice-T's rise to fame, with all its ups and downs, from her perspective, was incredible. I was someone who watched the cop killer controversy unfold from a safe distance, and I was amazed at the scope of it even then. I can't imagine how it must have felt to be in the middle of it, especially with a newborn to protect. But somehow Darlene did it, and we're glad she chose our show to tell her story. Make sure to check out Darlene's great memoir, Definition of Down, which you can find at overtheedgebooks.com. Join us next week when we talk to a producer who played a key role on Dr. Dre's new Compton album, DJ Dahi. We'll discuss that and also his work on songs like Kendrick Lamar's Money Trees, Drake's Worst Behavior, his own solo album, Toys, and a whole lot more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our monthly newsletter. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Yeah, and he was so upfront, and that turned me on even more.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
If not, it would have really been, like, entirely scary. But it was scary.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Ugh, horrible.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I don't care. This guy is fly.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jonathan Waitman.
Confusing.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Those few years right there where it was just like deep with all that, that they just did all these. Yeah, Donnie.
Man, I used to love Donnie. Because at that time, Donnie was bigger than Oprah.
Oh, for sure. Oh, no, for sure.
Oh, absolutely.